Welcome to Holden Village. In the fireside room this afternoon, our speaker is Paul Olson, and he will be speaking on one-man play, Pilgrimage with Poets. Let's listen in.
I'm going out to fetch the little calf that's standing by the mother. It's so young, it totters when she licks it with her tongue. I shan't be gone long. You come too. I do not say these things for a dollar, or to fill up the time while I wait for a boat. It is you talking as much as myself. I act as the tongue of you. Tied in your mouth, in me it begins to be loosened. Poetry considers every part of life, from before birth to beyond death. And poetry's primary concern, unlike sometimes what we've learned in school, is not with beauty, not with persuasion, not even with philosophical truth. Poetry's primary concern is with experience. All those common, everyday experiences of our lives, some of which are funny, some of which are sad, but are all part of our pilgrimage. It's about the ball, the bat, the mitt. Ball hits bat, or it hits mitt. Bat doesn't hit ball. Ball meets bat. Ball bounces off bat and flies air, or thuds ground dud. Or it fits mitt. Bat waits for ball to mate. Ball hates to take bat's bait. Ball flirts, bat's late, don't keep the date. Ball goes in, thwack to mitt, and goes out, thwack, back to mitt. Ball fits mitt, but not all the time. Sometimes ball gets hit, pow, when bat meets it and sails to a place where mitt in disgrace has to quit. That's about the bases loaded. That's about 40,000 fans exploded. It's about the ball, the bat, the mitt, the bases, and the fans. It's done on a diamond, and for fun, it's about home, and it's about run. Poised between going on and back, pulled both ways, taut like a tightrope walker, fingertips pointing the opposites. Now bouncing on tiptoe like a dropped ball or a kid skipping rope. Come on, come on. Running a scattering of steps sidewise. See how he teeters, tingles, skitters, teases, taunts them. Hovers like an ecstatic bird. He's only flirting. Crowded, crowded. Delicate. Delicate. Remember how you won that last race? How you flung your body at the start? How your spikes ripped the cinders in the stretch? How you catapulted through the tape? Do you remember? Don't you think I lurched with you out of those starting holes? Don't you think my sinews tightened at those first few strides? And as you flew into the stretch, was not all my thrill of 1,000 races in your blood? And at your final drive, through the finish, did not my shout tell of the triumphant ecstasy of victory? Live as I've taught you to run, gal. It's a short dash. Dig your starting holes firm and deep. Lurch out of them into the straightaway with all the power that's in you. Look straight ahead to the finish line. Think only of the goal. Run straight. Run high. Run hard. Save nothing. And finish with an ecstatic burst that carries you hurtling through the tape to victory. Teeth bare to the wind, white knuckle grip on handlebars, you push the pedals of no return. let loose new motion and speed, and the earth turns with the multiplied force of your wheels. Do not look back. Feet light on the brakes. Ride the bicycle of your will down the spine of the world, ahead of your time, into life. I will not say go slow. Arithmetic is where numbers fly like pigeons in and out of your head. Arithmetic is 7-Eleven, all good children go to heaven, or 5-6 bundle of sticks. Arithmetic tells you how many you've won or lost if you know how many you had before you won or lost. Arithmetic is where you have to multiply, and you carry the multiplication table around in your head and hope you don't lose it. If you ask your mother for one fried egg for breakfast, and she gives you two fried eggs, and you eat both of them, who's better at arithmetic, you or your mother? Poetry on the page often leaves us with lots of questions. What's this about? And poetry really just clarifies experience. The common, everyday experience of our life gets order and shape and sometimes meaning in the context of a poem. A snake came to my water trough on a hot, hot day, and I in pajamas for the heat to drink there. In the deep, strange, scented shade of the great dark carob tree, I came down the steps with my pitcher and must wait, must stand there and wait, for there he was at my water trough before me. He reached down from a fissure in the earth wall in the gloom and trailed his yellow, brown, slackness, soft belly down over the edge of the stone trough and rested his throat upon the stone bottom, where the water dripped from the tap in a small clearness. He sipped with his straight mouth, softly drank through his straight gums into his slack, long body silently. Someone was before me at my water trough. And I, like a second comer, waiting. He lifted his head from his drinking, as cattle do. He looked at me vaguely, as drinking cattle do. Then flickered his two forked tongue from his lips and mused a moment. He stooped and drank a little more, being earth brown, earth golden from the burning, burning bowels of the earth. And the voice of my education said to me, he must be killed. For here the black snakes are innocent, the gold are venomous. And voices inside me said, if you were a man, you would take a stick and break him down and finish him off. Must I confess how I liked him? How glad I was he had come like a guest in quiet to drink at my water trough and depart, peaceful, pacified, and thankless, into the burning, burning bowels of the earth. Was it cowardice I dare not kill him? Was it perversity that I longed to talk to him? Was it humility to feel so honored? I felt so honored. And yet those voices, if you were not afraid, you would kill him. And truly, I was afraid. I was most afraid. Yet even so, honored still more that he should seek my hospitality from out the dark door of the secret earth. He drank enough and lifted his head dreamily as one who was drunken. And looked around like a god, unseeing, into the air, and flickered his two forked tongue like night, so black, licking his lips. Looked around and turned and made his way up the broken bank of my wall face. And as he put his head into that dreadful hole and slowly drew up, snake-easing his shoulders and entered farther, a sort of horror, a sort of protest against his withdrawing himself into that horrid black hole, deliberately going into the blackness and slowly drawing himself after, overcame me now as back was turned. I looked around, I put down my pitcher, I picked up a clumsy log, and I threw it at the water trough with a clatter. I think it did not hit him. But suddenly, that part of him which was left behind, convulsed in undignified wrath, and like lightning, was gone into the black hole, into the earth-lipped fissure of the wall front, at which, in the intense still noon, I stared in fascination. And immediately I regretted it. I thought, how paltry, how vulgar, what a mean act! And I despised myself and the voices of my accursed human education. I thought of the albatross, and I wished he'd come back, my snake. To me, he seemed like a king in exile, uncrowned in the underworld, now due to be crowned again. I have something to expiate, a pettiness. And I missed my chance with one of the lords of life. In a shoebox, stuffed in an old nylon stocking, sleeps the baby mouse I found in the meadow, where he trembled and shook beneath the stick till I caught him up by the tail, brought him in, cradled in my hand. A little Quaker, the whole body of him trembling, his absurd whiskers sticking out like a cartoon mouse, his feet like small leaves, little lizard feet, whitish and spread wide when he tried to struggle away, wriggling like a minuscule puppy. Now he's eaten his three kinds of cheese and drunk from his bottle-capped water trough. So much, he just lies in one corner, his tail curled under him, his belly big as his head, his bat-like ears twitching and tilting toward the least sound. Do I imagine he no longer trembles when I come close to him? He seems no longer to tremble. But this morning, the shoebox house on the back porch is empty. Where is he gone, my meadow mouse? My thumb of a child and muzzled in my palm. To run under the hawk's wing. Under the eye of the great owl watching from the elm tree. To live by the courtesy of the snake and the shrike and the tomcat. I think of the nestling fallen into the deep grass. The turtle gasping in the dusty rubble on the highway. The paralytic stunned in the tub. And the water rising. All things innocent, hapless, forsaken. Gwendolyn Brooks's poem, The Mother, is about abortion. She does not take a religious or political or social stand. She clarifies an intense experience. Abortions will not let you forget. You remember the children you got that you did not get. The damp, small pulps with a little or no hair. The singers and workers who never handled the air. You'll never neglect them or beat them or silence or buy with a sweet. You'll never wind up the sucking thumb and scuttle off ghosts that come. You'll never leave them. Controlling your luscious sigh in return for a snack of them with a gobbling mother eye. I have heard in the voices of the wind, the voices of my dim, killed children. I have contracted. I have eased my dim dears at the breasts they could never suck. I have said sweets, if I sinned, if I seized your luck and your lives from your unfinished reach, if I stole your births and your names, your straight baby tears and your games, your stilted and lovely loves, your tumults, your marriages, your aches, your deaths. If I poisoned the beginnings of your breaths, believe that even in my deliberateness, I was not deliberate. But why should I whine? Whine that the crime was other than mine, since anyhow you are dead. Or rather, or instead, you were not made. But that too, I am afraid, is faulty. What shall I say? How is the truth to be said? You were born, you lived, you died. It's just that you never giggled or planned or cried. Believe me, I loved you. Believe me, I knew you, though faintly. And I loved you all. So the power of images, pictures. Poets intensify experience. And I think the poets would argue that to be intensely alive is the opposite of being dead. Curiosity may have killed the cat. More likely the cat was just unlucky. Or else curious to see what death is like, having no cause to go on licking paws and fathering litter on litter of kittens predictably. Nevertheless, to be curious is dangerous enough. To distrust what is always said, what seems, to ask odd questions, interfere in dreams, to run away, smell rats, have hunches, does not endear cats to those doggy circles where well-smelt baskets, suitable wives, and good lunches are the order of things, and where prevails much wagging of incurious heads and tails. Face it, curiosity will not cause him to die. Only lack of it will. Never to want to see the other side of the hill, or that improbable country where living is an idol, although a probable hell, would kill us all. Only the curious have, if they live, a tale worth telling at all. Dogs say he loves too much, is changeable, irresponsible, marries too many wives, deserts his children, chills all dinner tables with tales of his nine lives. Well, he's lucky. Let him be nine-lived and contradictory, curious enough to change and prepared to pay the cat price, which is to die and die again and again, and each time with no less pain. The cat minority of one is all that can be counted on to tell the truth. And what he has to tell on each return from hell is this. Dying is what the living do. Dying is what the loving do. And the dead dogs are those who do not know that hell is where to live you have to go. Here's the happy bounding flea. You cannot tell the he from she. The sexes look alike, you see. But she can tell, and so can he. The honey bee is sad and cross and wicked as a weasel. And when she perches on you, boss, she leaves a little measle. I shoot the hippopotamus with bullets made of platinum. For when I use the leaden ones, his skin is sure to flatten them. Turtle lives twixt plated decks, which practically conceal its sex. I think it's clever of the turtle in such a fix to be so fertile. The primal termite knocked on wood, tasted it, and found it good. And that is why your cousin May fell through her parlor floor today. Poems that rhyme make us laugh. Nikki Giovanni, one of the so-called black revolutionary poets, looks at art with eyes that some of us don't have. I wanted to write a poem that rhymes, but revolution doesn't lend itself to bebopping. My neighbor, who thinks I hate, asked, "Do you ever write tree poems?" I like trees. I said, "I'll do a beautiful green tree poem." Peeked from my window to check the image. Noticed the schoolyard was covered with asphalt. No green, no trees grow in Manhattan. Well, then I thought the sky. I'll do a big blue sky poem. But all the clouds have winged low since no Dick Nixon was elected. Well then, I thought again. And it occurred to me maybe I shouldn't write at all. But clean my gun and check my kerosene supply. Perhaps these are not poetic times at all. Another of the so-called black revolutionary poets, Donnell Lee, understands the power of society to define and shape our very identity, and how some of us get caught up in the power of society and don't have any idea of who we really are. The title of this poem is, "But He Was Cool, or He Even Stopped for Green Lights." Super cool, ultra black, tan, purple, he had a beautiful shade. He had a double natural that would put the sisters to shame. His dashikis were tailor-made, his beads were imported seashells from some black country I never heard of. He was triple hip, cool, cool, super cool, real cool. His tikis were hand-carved out of ivory and came express from the motherland. He would greet you in Swahili, say goodbye in Yoruba. Ooh, Jim, he'd be so cool and intelligent. Cool, cool, super cool, so cool. He was uncooled by other black dudes cool. Cool, cold, cool, bob cool, icebox cool, so cool. His wine didn't have to be cooled. His was air-conditioned cool. Cool, cool, super cool, real cool made me cool. Now he that cool. Cool, cool, super cool, so cool. Him nicknamed refrigerator. Cool, cool, super cool, real cool. He didn't know. After Detroit, Newark, Chicago, Watts, L.A., cool, cool, super cool, real cool. But to be black is to be very hot. Poets clarify for us what is good and what is evil, and they enable us to know the difference. General, your tank is a strong machine. It can break down a wood, crush 100 men, but it has one problem. It needs a driver. General, your plane is an amazing machine. Can fly faster than storm, carry more than an elephant. But it has one problem. It needs a flyer. General, man is a useful machine. He can fly and he can kill. But he has one problem. He can think. Another of the so-called black revolutionary poets, Sonia Sanchez, looks at America's favorite pastime, baseball, with eyes different from most of us. say, can you see? On the baseball diamond, all the fans clapping for their black players, yeah. There ain't nothing like a black man playing in the noonday sun for us fun, love, and spectators. Why, sometimes they seem even human. That is to say, every now and then. Hooray! Hoorah! Hooray! My, who's that black dude in the mound? They can't get no batters past him. Wonder where he was found. Makes you wonder if this is still a white man's game. Who's that? Oh, God, yes, another white hero to save us from total blackness. Carl Yastrzemski? Yastrzemski, 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 yeah. It's America's most famous pastime. And the name of the game ain't baseball. Richard Wright's Between the World and Me is a poem I've done in lots of high schools and colleges. And I had always been the poet, the speaker, the song of the poem. That is, the black Richard Wright stumbling upon the remains of a lynching. It's interesting somewhat to know that as late as 1948 and as far north as Kansas, there were 11 lynchings. It's interesting to note that as late as 1994 in Dubuque, Iowa, there were crosses burned on the lawns of black people. The poem applies universally. And I was this black man stumbling upon the remains of a lynching. And one night in Michigan in front of a largely black audience, I became a white man stumbling upon the remains of a lynching. The power of the poem suggests we all are of the same family. One morning while in the woods, I stumbled suddenly upon the thing. Stumbled upon it in a grassy clearing guarded by scaly oaks and elms. And the sooty details of the scene rose, thrusting themselves between the world and me. There's a design of white bones slumbering forgottenly upon a cushion of ashes. There was a charred stump of a sapling pointing a blunt finger accusingly at the sky. There were torn tree limbs, tiny veins of burnt leaves, a scorched coil of greasy hemp, a vacant shoe, a ripped shirt, an empty tie, a lonely hat, and a pair of trousers stiff with black blood. And upon the trampled grass there were matches, butt ends of cigars and cigarettes, peanut shells, drained gin flask, and a whore's lipstick. Scattered traces of tar, restless arrays of feathers, and the lingering smell of gasoline. And through the morning air, the sun poured yellow surprise into the eye sockets of a stony skull. And while I stood there, my mind was frozen with a cold pity for the life that was gone. The ground gripped my feet. My heart was circled with icy walls of fear. The sun died in the sky. The night wind muttered in the grass and fumbled with the leaves on the trees. The woods poured forth a hungry yelping of hounds. The witnesses rose and lived. The dry bones stirred, rattled, lifted, melting themselves into my bones. The gray ashes formed flesh, firm and black, entering into my flesh. Cigars and cigarettes glowed. The gin flask passed from mouth to mouth. The whore smeared lipstick red upon her lips. And a thousand faces swirled around me, clamoring that my life be burned. And then they had me, stripped me, battering my teeth into my my throat till I swallowed my own blood. My voice was drowned in the roar of their voices, and my black, wet body slipped and rolled in their hands as they bound me to the sapling. My skin clung to the bubbling hot tar falling from me in limp patches, and the down and quills of the white feathers sank into my raw flesh, and I moaned in my agony. Then my blood was cooled mercifully, cooled by a baptism of gasoline. And in a blaze of red, I leaped to the sky as pain rose like water, boiling my limbs. Begging, panting, I clutched childlike. Clutched to the hot sides of death. Now, I am dry bones, and my face a stony skull, staring in yellow surprise at the sun. Perhaps nowhere in literature is the pain and ambiguity of understanding death so evident as it is in Shakespeare's King Lear. Lear, who is now old, somewhat senile, stripped of his kingship, has stumbled upon the remains of his wrongly hanged daughter. He knows she is dead, but in this naive, ambiguous hope, he just hopes she's still alive. And he carries her out among the people.
Oh, you men of stone! Had I your tongues and eyes, I'd use them so that heaven's vault should crack. She is gone forever. I know when one is dead and when one lives. She is dead as earth. Lend me your looking glass. If that her breath should mist or stain the stone, why then she lives. A plague upon you, murderers, traitors all! I might have saved her. Now she's gone forever. Cordelia. Cordelia. Stay a little. What is thou sayest? Her voice was ever gentle, soft, and low. An excellent thing in woman. And I have killed the slave that was a-hanging thee. Did I not tell? I have seen the day when my good biting sword would have made men skip. I am old now, and these crosses spoil me. Who are you? My eyes are not the best, I'll tell you straight. And my poor fool is hanged. No. No life? Why should a dog, a horse, a rat have life and thou no breath at all?
Poetry can clarify for us what we believe in. Langston Hughes has a 10-second poem, but if you don't listen carefully, you'll miss it. A statement about institutionalized, organized religion. In an envelope marked personal, God addressed me a letter. In an envelope marked personal, I have given my answer. The wise guys tell us that Christmas is kid stuff. Maybe they got something there. 2,000 years ago, three wise guys chased the star across the continent to bring frankincense and myrrh to a kid born in a manger with an idea in his head. And as the bombs crash all over the world today, the real wise guys know that we've all got to go chasing stars again in the hope that we can get back some of that kid stuff born 2,000 years ago. How we try to clean it up, that manger mess in Bethlehem, and make the stables courtly. Carols dance with light. Wassail carries charity and cheer. Bem porcelains present a creche, all done in white, exquisite, lovely to the touch. I bought the rabbit, it was what I could afford. Dear burning babe, and is this wrong? We are. Christ climbed down from his bare tree this year and ran away to where there were no rootless Christmas trees hung with candy canes and breakable stars. Christ climbed down from his bare tree this year and ran away to where there were no gilded Christmas trees, no tinfoil Christmas trees, no tinsel Christmas trees, no gold Christmas trees, no powder blue Christmas trees, no pink plastic Christmas trees, hung with electric lights, encircled with tin electric trains and clever cornball relatives. Christ climbed down from his bare tree this year and ran away to where no itinerant Bible salesman went around the territory in a two-tone Cadillac selling Sears and Roebuck creches complete with plastic babe in the manger, the babe arrived by special delivery. Christ climbed down from his bare tree this year and ran away to where no fat, handshaking stranger went around in a red flannel suit and a fake white beard, offering himself off as some sort of North Pole saint crossing the desert into Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, in a Volkswagen sled drawn by rollicking Adirondack reindeer with German names, bearing sacks of gifts from Saks Fifth Avenue for everybody's imagined Christ child. Christ climbed down from his bare tree this year and ran away to where no Bing Crosby carolers moaned of a tight Christmas. There were no Radio City Angels ice skating wingless through a winter wonderland into a jingle bell heaven daily at 8:30 with midnight mass matinees. Christ climbed down from his bare tree this year and softly stole away into some anonymous Mary's womb again, where in the darkest night of everybody's anonymous soul, he awaits again. An unimaginable and impossibly immaculate reconception. The very craziest of second comings. Poets take us on a journey from our childhood experiences that are simple to the adult experiences that are complex. And that pilgrimage weaves its way from innocence to experience and finally clarifies for us who we are and what we are. But I think that all poets ultimately celebrate life. I thank you, God, for most this amazing day, for the leaping greenly spirits of trees, for the true blue dream of sky, and for everything which is infinite, which is natural, which is yes, For I, who have died, am alive again today. This is the sun's birthday. This is the birthday of life and of love and of that gay, great happening illimitably earth. How should tasting, touching, hearing, seeing, smelling, breathing, any lifted from the know of nothing, human merely being, dot unimaginable you? Now the ears of my ears are awakened, and the eyes of my eyes are opened. Two roads diverged in the yellow wood. I'm sorry I could not travel both and be one traveler. Long I stood and looked on one as far as I could to where it bent in the undergrowth. And then took the other. It's just as fair, perhaps, and having a better claim, because it was grassy and wanted wear, though as for that, the passing there had worn them really about the same. Oh, I saved the first for another day. Yet, knowing how way leads on to way, I doubted if I should ever come back. And both that morning equally lay in leaves that no step had trodden black. I shall be telling this with a sigh somewhere ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in a wood. And I took the one less traveled by. And that has made all the difference. Over 300 years ago, John Milton explained for me why anyone would bother to memorize poetry. I have long since been persuaded that to say or do anything worth memory and imitation, no purpose or respect should sooner move us than simply the love of God and of humankind.